Welcome all to the Lowy Institute and Penguin special joint event. It's a book launch for Sam Roggeveen's very first authored piece, Our Very Own Brexit. Some housekeeping first, your phones to silent. And we'll have plenty of time for questions, but we're going to have a discussion first, tease out some of the arguments in the book, and then when the questions come, there'll be roving microphones. Can I see the mics? Right up the back. But we'll have someone down the front and just throw your hand up and then we'll start to pick you off one at a time and continue the discussion. And before we commence the talk, pay my respects obviously to the two Indigenous leaders, past, present and emerging. We're on the right side of the Yarra, so we're in Kulin territory, Wurundjeri people. If we're on the other side of the Yarra, we'd be in different country. It's always important to remember where we are, I think, when we have a discussion like this. I'm going to throw to Sam. I'm going to give Sam the opening thought just to explain the process by which he came to write this little book. Normally, Lowy is externally focused with implications for Australia, but you've reversed the lens for this particular work. You've started looking locally and drawing international implications for us.
Well, thanks, George, and also thanks for your contribution to the book. I really appreciate it. Thank you, everyone, for coming this evening. Yes, it's an unusual piece for the Lowy Institute, which is a think tank that looks outwards. I think I would the best way to maybe describe my approach is to think of an analogy. So if we were sitting here tonight and I was talking here about a book that I'd written about, say, Egypt, then you would probably hope that a book like that described, if it was a book about contemporary Egyptian politics, it ought to have something to say, for instance, about the Muslim Brotherhood. It ought to have something to say about the Sunni-Shia divide, or about Egypt's relations with Israel, or about America. So, in other words, a book about contemporary Egyptian politics which doesn't look beyond the boundaries, the national boundaries of Egypt, is an incomplete one. And yet it's striking to me how seldom we adopt that kind of approach when we look at Australian politics, with the notable exception of the gentleman sitting to my left. I think most of our commentators on Australian politics treat our politics as more or less sui generis. But as an international affairs specialist, I thought, well, let's start on the outside and then work our way in. And it seems to me when you do that, you come to actually quite different conclusions about the stability and the, let's say the long-term viability of our of the two-party duopoly in Australia. And, we can go on and talk about that.
Yes. And the title, Our Very Own Brexit, there's a word missing there. Trump is obviously not involved here. And I tend to find when we're talking about international affairs, if I can assure the audience that that guy doesn't get a mention at all, people relax. Or if we are going to talk about him, we'll talk about him at the end. Why Brexit and not the US election in 2016? Why does Brexit have greater saliency for the Australian situation than, say, the American?
Well, first of all, I think Britain just has greater saliency because the origins of our political system, of our parliamentary system, are British, and because party politics is so central to my argument, and the evolution of our major political parties is really at the core of the argument, that the analogy is easier to draw, not just with Britain, but also with Europe, where there are a lot of also parliamentary systems which are different to ours, but at least probably have more similarities than the American system, where presidential politics tend to take the forefront, and also where party affiliations are different. When you register to vote, you register with a party in the United States, or at least in most states you do. So the dynamics work a little differently with regard to party politics in the US. Nevertheless, Trump, unfortunately, does make an appearance in the book, hard to avoid. And I would argue that the trends that I'm talking about with regard to people's slow but steady disaffection, they're pulling away from the two major parties, that is happening in the States, just as it's happening here and in the UK and in Europe.
Yeah, although obviously in the American case, there's still a duopoly, and the barrier to entry for a third party is a lot higher than it is in our system or in the British system.
And so what happens when the duopoly is that strong is that you get the independents, rather than coming in as independents, they come in and infiltrate the party system, which is exactly what Trump did. I mean, Trump is the classic rhino, Republican in name only. So he essentially saw the weakness of the party system, realised that a third party candidacy simply wasn't viable, and so he infiltrated that system. And I would argue that actually something quite similar has happened in Australia over the last few years, and the two stellar examples are Rudd and Turnbull. Yep. These are two individuals who, neither of whom are dyed-in-the-wool party figures, both of whom actually are figures of some suspicion within their respective parties because, in Rudd's case, they weren't tightly union-affiliated or union-backed, and in Turnbull's case, was ideologically suspect because he'd been hanging out with Neville Rand for so long. Mm. So these were both outsiders. Rudd basically infiltrated, I think, through sheer grit and got to where he was. Turnbull did it through a little bit of charisma and money. Money helped. But both did it as individuals who came from outside that party system. And yet eventually the parties, the residual strength of our major parties was enough to eventually turf them out.
So we had, just to remind the audience, in the first 110 years of Federation, there was a leadership spill for the governing party called on only three occasions. One of them led to a change in Prime Minister, which was Hawke de Keating. There were two spills that year, but essentially that's the one episode. The other one, which was McMahon on Gorton, was a tie, and Gorton sacked himself. And the third one was Fraser on Peacock in 82, and Fraser was... was reaffirmed as Prime Minister. So that was 3 in 110 years. We've had, I've lost count, what is it, six or eight in the last 8 years with four changes of Prime Minister. So something is obviously shifted in the conduct of party politics in the second decade of the 21st century. So maybe tease out the whys and wherefores in Australia and what the parallels you draw overseas.
So what's shifted, and this is the part where it helps to start from the outside in. So you start from a perspective on Western politics, so politics in mature Western democracies, and then work your way into Australia. And I think the near universal phenomenon is that the major centre-left and centre-right political parties in all those democracies are in decline, which is to say they're losing members and they're losing vote share. Now, why has that happened? Well, I think the Australian case actually illustrates the point for the broader example. And in Australia's case, what's happened is essentially that our economies and our societies have changed. So the Labor Party was founded as the political wing of the union movement. And today, of course, we've gone to a situation in which less than 15% of our workforce is unionised. I think less than 10% if you take out the public sector.
True.
So we've got a political party which is designed, founded to represent a social and an economic base which no longer exists. Okay, so now you'd think in circumstances like that that the Liberal Party would thrive, and in a sense it has, because the Liberal Party has spent much more time in office in the post-war period, and particularly in the last 20 years, than Labor has. But of course, the Liberal Party is in decline too, just like centre-right parties all over the Western world. It too has lost membership. Both major parties are now in the realm of, I think, around 50,000 members in what is a rapidly growing population. So the party membership is declining while the population is booming. So why has the Liberal Party also gone into decline when you would assume in circumstances where Labor has gotten weaker that would benefit the Liberals? Well, to me, the answer is that whereas the Labor Party was founded as the political arm of the union movement, the Liberal Party was founded actually to oppose the interests of the union movement, the interests of capital versus the interests of labour. Classic post-war industrial age political duopoly. But when organised labour implodes as a social and economic movement, what's the Liberal Party for anymore, right? Why do you need a Liberal Party if there is no union movement to oppose? And so the Liberal Party goes into decline as well. And it too is a political movement with no actual social or economic base to represent. And when these parties go backwards, when they go into decline, they become less stable. And in Australia, I think one of the symptoms of that is that is leadership churn.
Yep. And the we were swapping these data points before. It's interesting to reflect on the election we've just had. It's only the fourth time since the formation of the Model Liberal Party where there's been a swing on primary vote against both main parties. Now, the previous three occasions it happened, late 50s when the DLP came into play, so both Labor and Liberal votes, both Labor and Coalition votes fell at the 58 election. It happened again in 77 when the Australian Democrats were formed. It happened again in 1990 where Bob Hawke, convinced by Graham Richardson, told voters, whatever you do, I know you don't want to vote for us, but make sure you put us second. So there was a second preference strategy which permitted voters on both sides, for both main parties, to put someone else first, which was the Democrats. This last election, there's almost no reason other than fatigue with the main parties.
Right.
Both main parties, and it's only the fourth time, as I said, that's happened, they've both seen their primary vote share fall. And in fact, the combined primary vote of the two main parties now is at its lowest level since the Great Depression. So a full quarter of all Australians now, 25% of all Australians, have voted for someone other than Labor or the Coalition at the last federal election. Now, I could say, if you counted the Green vote back in into the Labor column, that it's situation normal, but it's not situation normal at the moment, is it?
No, well, I mean, why would you count the Green vote? I mean, the Greens are a real thing, right? That's yeah. That's a real movement. It's worth adding, too, that you know, the Labor Party's share of the primary vote has gone into steady decline in for the last 30 years, really, broken only by, to a significant degree, by Kevin Rudd, who's, you know, the guy they deposed crazily. The more I think about this, George, the more ridiculous it seems.
You've got a second book in you.
Yeah, that's a second book. But
he's written two volumes already.
Yes. I can't compete.
Anyone read it, by the way? No hands? Maybe.
Really?
Sorry.
Actually, just as a side note here, so I think on Thursday the Labor Party is going to release the report that the two senior, I can't remember who they are, two senior Labor Party figures have written a report about what went wrong at the 2019 election. It seems to me a true test of what of Labor today will be how seriously they take the fact of Rudd's victory in 2007. Because don't forget, Labor has only won one election outright since 1993, and that's Kevin Rudd in 2007. But he has more or less been whitewashed as a kind of as a figure from the Labor Party. I mean, they still invite him to launches and things, but he's widely despised. And it seems to me the test of this report, when it comes out on Thursday, is how seriously do they treat what they did right in 2007 when Rudd got elected, or do they ignore it? Like, okay, this never happened, yeah. You know, something like that.
But then again, this comes back to your thesis. So there's also a structural break since that election. So even if you put Kevin back into the chair at the 2010 election, they still would have lost all those seats in Queensland with him as Prime Minister. Because the counterfactual is 2013 he ran as Prime Minister because he got his old job back, and he only won six seats in Queensland the second time around. Well, Shorten won more seats for the Labor Party at the subsequent election in 2016 than Kevin won for the Labor Party in 2016. And the difference is, between 2007 and every other election since for Labor, is that they got smashed in Queensland. Just get you to think through that polarity between the southeastern corner and Queensland, and how that plays out in some of the other jurisdictions you've had a look at. Because a lot of the identity by region now seems to be the only way people can come back to a political identity now that a lot of those old class-based identities don't exist.
Well, for me, what it speaks to more broadly is simple volatility by the voters. So voters are just not araldited to single parties the way they used to be. So in European politics, as much as here, a couple of generations ago, you voted the way your parents voted, and they voted the way their parents voted, and the party you voted for was tied to, you know, the class you belonged to, the job, the kind of job you had or your parents had, the church you went to, and so on. All of those, you know, social connections to party politics have almost entirely disappeared. And so voters are free to go where they want. So in terms of the regions, I mean, not only at the national level, but we've seen incredible volatility in Victorian politics, for instance, over the last few years. Campbell Newman in Queensland, I mean, what was that about? Within a single term, got thrown out. And just to come back to the thesis of the book, what that means is that the big political parties are just far less stable and they're far more vulnerable to shocks from their own backbenchers, from their own insiders. And that's what happened in the United Kingdom. So, as I quote in the book, in 2010, the year David Cameron came to office, the polling firm Ipsos used to take a poll every month asking essentially, well, what do you think the biggest challenge to Britain is today? And in October of 2010, the year David Cameron came to office, the grand total of the percentage that said that Brexit or that Europe was the most important challenge for Britain was 1% in 2010. And 6 years later, there's a referendum and they decide to get out of the EU. Now, how the hell did that happen? You can't explain it by the fact that the people kind of revolted.
Yep.
There were no marches on the streets. Nobody was breaking windows. This was cooked up inside the Conservative Party. And previous prime ministers had the authority to be able to put down that Eurosceptic sentiment. Thatcher could do it. Major could do it. But Cameron couldn't because he was bleeding votes to the right. He was bleeding votes to UKIP. And his own backbench was mobilised, and he simply lacked the authority to resist them, and so they had to call this referendum. And here we are.
Could he have got? That horse is well and truly bolted now. But could he have got away with not calling a referendum?
Look, I don't know.
I trust you've been deeper in the weeds than I will ever get on Brexit in particular, but.
Actually, no, George. I mean, my perspective on this is really restricted to the fact that to what triggered it really, and the fact that it is weakness inside political parties that causes outsized consequences for societies, and that's why I'm very careful in the book. So the analogy I draw with Brexit to Australia is that we could do something similar to what the Brits did by breaking. The Brits broke away from Europe through Brexit. We can break away from Asia if we make a radical turn away from immigration, right? And so I'm very careful in the book to say this won't be driven from the bottom up. There is not this kind of racist underbelly in Australia that a lot of, I think, critics on the left worry about, that there's some kind of, nascent xenophobic racist movement in Australia. If you scratch the surface of our tolerant selves, you'll find a bunch of, white supremacists. I think that's mostly a fantasy.
Yep.
Where the analogy lies is that one of the major parties becomes so unstable that it cooks up something like this out of desperation, that it basically takes a position to the election where it says, Australia is full. And at that point, we are, in fact, if one side of politics says, no, we continue with our immigration program more or less as is, high immigration model, and the other party says, no, Australia is full, at that point, we're holding a de facto referendum on Australia's place in Asia.
Yeah. Before we get to that part of it, I'm not trying to throw you off course.
Yep.
Have we already had a version of that with the climate change debate? So think about the policy advice, which is about acting. Think about the regional and the sort of global interest. Australia is a resource-rich nation wanting to go first before the rest of the world puts a price on our head. And at the 2007 election, you got bipartisanship on the issue. So the argument in 2007 was the start date for an emissions trading system. It's not whether you believed in the science of climate change or not. Come the second half of 2009 on the coalition side, whilst Rudd is negotiating with Turnbull, you get something that begins on the blogs, a couple of News Limited websites, a couple of very prominent News Limited journos are banging this drum. There's a whole lot of emails being sent to some backbenchers, which create a sense of mass movement, where there isn't one. It's just an email tree that rattles a few people. And Tony Abbott wakes up one morning having just rung people like me a couple of months earlier to say, we've got to get this ETS thing off the table. Look, if they can't do the ETS, we should do a carbon price instead. And he wrote a, some of you might still remember, he wrote a piece for The Australian after he decided he thought this was the smartest thing Turnbull could do to just get this issue clear off the table. And we ran it on the front page, maybe try a carbon price instead, late 2009. So we went from there to not being able to do anything on an issue where you had bipartisanship in 2007. So the reason why I'm bringing that in is we've already seen what that movie looks like, and it's and there's no rhyme or reason to what happens after it starts because the advice means nothing.
Yeah. So it's a compelling argument, and I'll tell you why I agree with you in a minute. Yeah. The reason I didn't pick it is because the analogy with Brexit is so much neater for immigration because
I agree.
The issue that ties us to Asia. And we can talk a bit more in a moment about why immigration is so important for our relationship with Asia. But that's basically why I picked immigration, is because it has these big implications for our place in the world that climate change, for all its global implications, does not. But the reason it's compelling is because I've talked already a little bit about the way, about how political parties are getting smaller and about how they're losing their social base, right? So this is part of the phenomenon that I call hollowing out of politics in the book. So the first phase of hollowing out is that voters essentially pull back from the political parties. And I've already explained that, right? They stop joining political parties, the big political parties, and they stop voting for them in increasing numbers.
Stop identifying.
Stop identifying. Thank you. Yes. Yep. The second part of hollowing out is that in reaction to voters pulling back from the parties pull back as well. So political parties find new ways to survive. When they can't rely on mass membership anymore, they say to themselves, okay, what else do we do? How else do we survive? And what they hit on, the example that they hit on, is to professionalise. And we're all aware of how this happens. So the first one part of professionalisation is that you develop a sort of cadre of political professionals. And we see this all the time now with, you know, the career path of a politician is you start in the university, you become an advisor in an MP's office. If you're lucky, you join a cabinet minister's office. Then you get pre-selection and so on. You move through the system that way. So the people, you know, the parties used to represent, I don't know, boilermakers and tradespeople and small business people. And those were the kind of people who actually became MPs. That doesn't happen anymore, right? Yeah. Party is filled with political operatives and political specialists. So the parties professionalise, right? The other thing they do is they start looking elsewhere for money. Big donors and increasingly the state. So they start looking at government for money. So in 1983, the Hawke government introduced public funding for election campaigns. And there's a very neat phrase in my book from an American political scientist named Henry Farrell, who said, political parties used to be a mechanism for the public to talk to the state. Now they're a tool for the state to talk to the public. Right? So essentially it's a form of you know, of cartelisation, really. The political parties form a cartel by attaching themselves to government in a way that makes them very hard to dislodge. Now, where was I going with that, George?
The this is your prologue.
So, when they cartelise, when they pull back like this, so there's a mutual withdrawal, right? The people pull back from the parties pull back as well, and you get a hole left in the middle. You get the hollow politics left in the middle. So the parties at this point, because they're self-contained, because they're professionals. The big thing that they begin to miss by not having a mass membership base to work towards is that they don't get signals anymore. They don't get signals from the ground up about what matters to people. And when you don't get those kind of signals, you instead have to look elsewhere for them. So where do they get them from? One is mass media, increasingly social media, and the other one they go to is their peers in foreign countries. So when you hear Scott Morrison, for instance, at the Lowy Institute a month ago talk about, what was it, negative globalism, phrases pulled, you know, almost word for word from the Trump playbook, that is a politician who is completely untethered, unmoored from a social and economic base, who gets no signals from the ground up about what matters to voters instead looking to peers overseas to decide to look, essentially search for signals about how to connect with the public.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's, I think, what happened. What you described in the case of on climate change. You got politicians, you know, hearing voices from Sky After Dark and from the Murdoch media, and not listening to a base which no longer existed.
Yeah, and the Labor Party, by the way, after they decided that this wasn't a good idea, even though it was a good idea in 2007. And remember, one of the first things Rudd did was to sign Kyoto, got a round of applause at a regional meeting, late 2007, early 2008. Australia was back in business as a, we're back to sort of that Gareth model of creative engagement. The Labor people decided after the politics turned against them that this was a popular movement forced on them by the left wing of their constituency, their narrow left base. And once that base had convinced them, had sold them this pup called climate change belief, they then did the U-turn to let's not talk about this issue anymore, which is so that's the other side of that coin. They reinterpreted their activism as a hijack. If that makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah. So you can never get this thing back once you're second guessing your motivation for doing these things. Let's get down to the. And I did want to leave it towards the sort of second half of the discussion. Hmm. The detail of migration. How would this question, and we're catastrophizing here. You're not saying it's going to happen in the next election or the election after.
A plausible worst case. I'm calling it. Yeah.
Okay. Walk me through the worst case and. Which party could it come from?
Yeah, okay. So I argue in the book this could come from either party. And so the reason that's important is because I think it's clear that there are elements of the Liberal Party that do have,
hang up about it.
Yeah, they do have, thank you very much, yeah. But it seems to me it can just as easily, perhaps even more easily, come from the Labor side, just because the Labor Party keeps losing, right? And when you keep losing, you start looking for ways to win. And so maybe, you know, there is an element inside the Labor Party, for instance, that, I mean, Bob Carr, after the 2000 Olympic Games, said Sydney's full. Hmm. I mean, how big a leap is it to get a national leader of the Labor Party saying Australia is full? Is that really such a big leap? I don't think so. So it seems to me it come from either party. The reason I think this is a nice analogy with Brexit is that high immigration is a point of elite bipartisan consensus, just as the relations with the EU were in the UK. Okay, so this was a point of elite consensus which was never tested really with the population. So both major parties in the UK took it for granted that Britain's, you know, slow, halting but gradual enmeshment with Europe was a good thing. And it seems to me because these parties became so disconnected from the public in the way that I just described earlier, they failed to recognise that the public had not bought into this sentiment. Now, it's not that the public was against it necessarily. They just hadn't paid any attention to it, and they certainly weren't invested in it the way that the political class was in the UK. So when they did eventually make the mistake of asking, the British people came back with the wrong answer. And it seems to me...
But in their head, didn't they just reframe the question? It became about control. It became about something else.
Well, you tell me, what do you think about... What does control mean to you?
Well, actually, I'll answer it in another way. What control means to the people who poll for conservative side of politics, both here and in the UK. And this dates all the way back to Tampa in 2001. And it does motivate a voter at the margin that would normally vote for Labor. So it turns that fraction of the Labor vote into a conservative vote. And it does it in the following ways. When the Tampa came on the horizon, a lot of the feedback the coalition were getting in their focus groups was that, and we'd been through a long decade of structural adjustment after the opening of the economy in the 80s and the recession in the early 90s. It was accepted when people were being tested on these questions, on questions about our place in the world, open economy, globalisation. There were a lot of things that people accepted were part of sort of the new Australian settlement, as Paul Kelly would call it. Mm. And those things couldn't be changed. You couldn't float the dollar again. You couldn't put the tariff wall back up again. You couldn't re-regulate the labour market. Clearly, people had gone too far on state governments and federal governments on privatisation. You could probably buy back things, but you couldn't do things that took you back to the 70s in terms of the government pulling all these levers in the economic space. People accepted that. But there were some things, and this is what the Tampa representatives, and there were some things that in an otherwise globalised setting you could demonstrate control. And in this, you know, this was obviously very visceral. It was about control of who came to your country and the circumstances in which they came. In the Brexit context, and I can guarantee you when Crosby was trying to stop people voting for Brexit on behalf of David Cameron, he would have looked at a piece of paper that said to him, bugger this, I've just spent the last 20 years convincing the Tory party to run campaigns along the lines of, are you thinking what I'm thinking? And the are you thinking what I'm thinking is, we've lost control of the thing that we may still be able to control as a set of island nations, that we should be able to decide who comes to our country. And I think the Brexit question was flipped in the same way that the Tampa question became a question about sovereignty. And sovereignty isn't about markets, and sovereignty isn't about capital flows. Sovereignty is about people. And I think that's... I'm sure even Johnson didn't even think of it in those terms. He was thinking about a narrow loss and then becoming Prime Minister because Cameron couldn't handle a narrow victory, right? Mm. Remember how quickly he ran from the field the day after they won? I've never seen a leader push for a vote and then not be able to explain what the hell he'd do with it after he got his worst dream confirmed for him. So I think in that space, there's the possibility of it in an Australian context. That's what control might mean. The only counter-argument I'd put is in the Australian context, we still have, and it's off the charts compared to other countries in the world when you test them on, is migration good for your country? You get 2/3 saying yes in Australia, where you barely get 50% in any other country.
Yeah.
What do migrants contribute to the economy, you know, better culture? So it'd be a very difficult question to ask directly. Mm. I guess my question for you is, and in fact, in a way, this is almost supporting. If another question gets posed and in people's heads it becomes about putting a pause on, and this is, I think, what you're arguing, you might even just ask for a situation for a couple of years pause, you know, until infrastructure catches up or...
Yeah, and that's I think Abbott and Dutton have floated that idea of a temporary reduction of a few tens of thousands a year in order to let infrastructure catch up. So I think for the analogy to work with Brexit, it has to be more severe than that. And so one political party or one faction within one political party has to say, no, Australia's
stop.
Full.
Stop.
Australia's full. We need to stop indefinitely. And at that point, if that gets taken to an election, then the voters are faced with a choice about, you know, are we a growing country or are we not a growing country? So I admit that's an extreme possibility.
Yeah.
But, you know, my counter-argument there is when I'm regularly now faced with people who say, well, that all seems a bit unlikely. And the obvious counter-argument is, well, so did Brexit.
So did Brexit.
But on the other hand, that's not quite enough. Okay, you've got to go further than that because just because one unlikely thing happened doesn't mean lots of unlikely things are going to happen. So what you've got to actually go on to say is that not just that Brexit happened, but there are all sorts of weird things happening in democracies. Trump,
yep.
There he is. You've got Emmanuel Macron, started a political movement a year before the election in France and won, an obscure cabinet minister. You've got electoral convulsions in Sweden, in Greece, in Italy, in the Netherlands. You know, the whole party political structure is changing. You and I were discussing before, Germany kind of looks like an island of stability because Merkel's been in charge for almost 14 years now. But beneath that, I mean, it's been all change, right? So the AfD, the populist right-wing party, is now the official opposition in the Bundestag. That party didn't exist when Angela Merkel first took the oath of office in Germany. At the Lowy Institute, we just hosted the Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, a few weeks ago. He's been Prime Minister for 9 years. Again, looks nice and stable. But he's led three governments in that time. all with different coalitions, right? The first one had the Greens involved in it. This one's got the centre-right Christian Democrats involved in the coalition government. So, you know, radical change is kind of the norm now, and it seems to me that we're nowhere near the period where that has ended in Australia, even though there's sort of a new conventional wisdom in Canberra now that period is over, that period of leadership instability is over and so on. But
who told you
I don't
that?
Buy that.
Who told you that? Name them. Get him to stand by that prediction.
Well,
at the next election.
There's a narrow argument that's justifiable because both parties have now changed their rules to make it much harder to launch these leadership coups. Okay.
Yeah.
And the second thing in favour of that argument is that the main instigators of all the trouble are
out
gone.
Of the system.
Yeah. Abbott primarily, but also Turnbull and Gillard. And there are still several others in the background that are there, but nevertheless, you know, the big bulls have left the stage. So you could argue narrowly that reduces the space for that kind of leadership instability. However, like I said, you've had Merkel on top for 14 years, and yet beneath that, the landscape has been utterly transformed. So this kind of instability that I'm talking about can manifest itself in lots of different ways.
We're about to go to questions. So, you know, once you get into the domestic sphere and you do a number of interviews, people start throwing questions at you about making predictions.
Yes.
And, of course, you want to take the academic, put the academic hat back on, which you can't do now because you've broken the seal on yourself in a way. The main parties themselves, do you see 10 years from now, Labor and Liberal with National Coalition partner, that configuration, that two-party, that main party system, been in the same shape it is 10 years from now than it is today? Or do you think that there's the possibility of one of them or both of them disappearing or imploding?
No, I think the most likely scenario is the first one.
Yeah.
But I think a continuation of steady decline where effectively we get a three-way split in the vote. Yeah. And at a certain point, like the voting system at the moment, you know, particularly in the lower house, favours the major parties. Yeah. So the 2016 election, for instance, the Labor Party's primary vote declined and they gained 14 seats. So, you know, the
compulsory
preferential voting favours the major parties. But at some point, the dam's going to break, I think. And even at this last election, you saw the coalition throwing money at blue ribbon seats like, you know, Tony Abbott's seat, Josh Frydenberg. Of course, they lost the Turnbull by-election the first time and then won it narrowly in the general election. So at some point, the dam breaks and then maybe you get a dozen people on the crossbench rather than four or five. Yep. And at that point, you've got permanent minority government. Now, it seems to me, in and of itself, that's not such a bad thing. We can live with that. A lot of democracies
you
do.
You can. Australian psych can't cope with it.
Yeah, well, that's...
Something about the convict part in our DNA says that we want to be led.
So yeah, maybe.
I think we might find minority government a bit difficult.
I'll never forget after the 2016 election, which was a double dissolution election, right, helped all sorts of minor parties get in to the Senate. And I'll never forget the day after on Insiders, Barry Cassidy sitting there saying, gee, they'll have to erect a circus tent on the grass out front of Parliament House to contain all this lot. And I thought, what utter contempt for the voters.
Oh, no, it's as if
they've...
Line.
No, it's a nice line. It made me angry because it almost presumed that the voters were... You know, there was contempt for the voters for being stupid enough to abandon the major parties. Yeah. And whereas the voters, for good reason, are saying, well, you know, what have you done for me lately? I think the most likely scenario is that gradual erosion of the base of the major parties continues. You get a larger crossbench, you get more minority governments, you know, which they do in New Zealand regularly, no problem there. The big problem is not the minor parties themselves. It's the way the big parties behave on their way down. And that, to me, is exactly what happened to the Conservative Party in Britain. This is a party in decline, just like all big centre-right and centre-left parties are. And as I said, as they decline, they get less stable and they become more vulnerable to their own backbenchers, and they become more vulnerable to the minor parties and the independents that are challenging them on the fringes, as happened to the Conservative Party with Nigel Farage and UKIP. So the real danger point is one of the major parties does something stupid in the midst of its decline. And one of those stupid things...
Can't afford to lose another 5 or 10 points off their primary vote and then...
Exactly. So one of those possible stupid things is that they say, you know, let's change your policy on immigration.
Now, we will go to questions almost immediately. One thing, and it's almost implied in your book, but the difficulty for us in managing our relations with Asia after we try, we're catastrophizing, we're back to the worst case scenario. It's very difficult to continue to trade with Asia when we said we don't want their people.
Right. Yes,
That's fundamentally the issue for us, isn't it?
I agree with you. I would caution that we shouldn't assume that Asian governments are sort of holier than thou about Australia. I mean, they traded with us fine when we had a white Australia policy before. Now things have changed a lot, of course, and the balance of power and the relative balances of power have changed. And none of these Asian countries which we trade with have particularly proud relations, records when it comes to, their own sort of minority populations either. You know, a lot of them, China at the front of the queue, actually, when it comes to their Uyghur population, for instance. So I don't want to overstate that problem. But yes, I do talk in the book briefly about Paul Kelly's argument in the 1980s that, the Hawke government essentially said, well, this can't go on. The last vestiges of white Australia have to be wiped away if we're going to open ourselves up to Asia. So we liberalise the economy, we open ourselves up, we take in immigrants from Asia, and that is the new Australian settlement, as he called it. Right? The problem is, in the process, is that he fast-tracked this disintegration of the political duopoly. So essentially by liberalising the Australian economy and bringing the unions into the accord process, he essentially pulled the teeth of the union movement, and it didn't exactly trigger the decline of the union movement in Australia, because that had happened before.
It was happening.
But it certainly accelerated it to the point now where, as we said earlier, less than 10% of Australians in the private sector belong to a union. Mm. So the whole political duopoly was grounded on this battle between capital and labour, and the Hawke government undermined it totally. So, that process which brought us to Asia, closer to Asia, also had that effect. Yeah.
Alrighty. Questions? Thanks again, by the way, for the first part of this show.
That was fascinating. Might have been a bit more fascinating if you actually took an outside view. Now, you said, OK, I'm taking an outside view, and what that consisted in for you was saying, look, similar things are happening in other countries. So this was an account of party political decline that was very party political focused. You talk about the parties, what are they doing to themselves, how do they relate to the voters? What you're not talking about is the massive external forces that are changing the situation in which parties exist and in which they relate to the voters. Now, you could list along many of them. The one I'm particularly interested in is international information warfare type activities. I mean, how could you talk about how Brexit happened without talking about the role of organisations like Cambridge Analytica and Russian oligarchs who they're connected with, who are actively influencing that election and the 2016 Trump election and so forth. These are surely outside forces that play an important role. You can't leave those out.
Yes, and as is so often the case when books or arguments are critiqued, what Tim is really saying is that I should have written a different book. But
another chapter.
Or maybe another chapter. And I did mention to George before we got up here that we should take the opportunity to think and to talk about new media and about social media. So let me take that opportunity. And, before that, let me preface that by saying that one response to your argument is that is in the book is that the decline of these political parties happened because economies and societies changed in similar ways in all these countries, right? So Australia, just like every advanced Western nation, went from a blue-collar economy to white, and that essentially started, I think, in the 1950s. And you can probably track the decline of unionism in Australia from that period. It started very slowly, but it did start around that time. So you've got huge economic changes, which were accelerated in the 1980s in Australia and all around the Western world through neoliberalism, as it's called. You've got the feminization of the workforce, the casualization of the workforce. And, of course, the big factor that I haven't talked about here but is a very big theme in the book is the Cold War. So the Cold War was part of the founding purpose, for instance, of the Liberal Party. The Liberal Party came into existence to fight communism. So in the decade of the 1980s, two things happened to the Liberal Party, which to me in the long term are fatal. One is that that clash between capital and labour essentially ended in Australia. And two, at the end of the decade, the Cold War ended. The Soviet Union collapsed. So the two founding purposes of the Liberal Party, to fight communism and to fight unions, just ended all at once. And so since then, you've had this long sort of existential crisis for the Liberal Party, and I would argue Labour too, but what they're actually for.
Not a bad one for them, though. They've still got to govern.
Exactly. The Liberals are still good still good at winning elections. On the new media side, yeah, of course, you can't ignore that point. I would argue that new media is essentially an accelerant of the kind of trends that I'm talking about. We've gone through a bit of a fairly radical reassessment of the influence of the internet on politics over the last 20 or so years. So if you start back in the 90s, really, in the early period, this was seen as a kind of a machine to liberalise the world. Right? So there was enormous techno-optimism. We were going to get a rebirth of democracy because everyone got a say, radical free speech and, no authoritarian government was going to be able to hold back. And over the 2000s, as social media emerged, I think that was reinforced. And I reckon the peak of that was around 2011, and that was the Arab Spring. And in the early period of the Arab Spring, we thought that Twitter and Facebook were actually going to roll over all these autocrats and dictators in the Middle East. And, of course, it didn't happen. In the end, what we got was, well, it happened in Tunisia, but that's about it. Everywhere else, we got new forms of autocracy and dictatorship. Soon after that, we also started seeing more stories emerging from China about how apparently successful the Chinese were being at suppressing the internet and at at essentially being able to contain the volatility and the potential of the internet to undermine party rule. And then even more recently, we have seen the potential, the kind of thing that Tim is talking about, the ability of the internet to not only that autocratic governments can use the internet, can contain the internet in their own countries, but they can actually use it to undermine democracies, right? So we've come a long way from that techno-optimism in the 90s towards extreme pessimism right now. I reckon both of them are wrong. I reckon actually the point I've arrived at is that the internet is really a machine for undermining all forms of authority, not just autocratic, not just dictatorial, but also democratic. Right? And the simple case I would make for that is that in an environment where information is scarce, institutions which have information are authoritative. Right? This is not my argument. This is an argument by an American writer called Martin Gurry, a little bit obscure, but look him up online and you'll find his blog, G-U-R-R-I. So in an environment where information is scarce, institutions which have information are authoritative. So the chief ones are the media and government. We now live in an environment not just of information abundance, but information superabundance. So the institutions which used to be authoritative no longer are. Okay, and among those are political parties, I think, and governments generally, but the media is another one. Where we've arrived is a moment where there are no authoritative institutions where people trust the information that's coming from them, and we're in a period of almost chronic mistrust. So one of Martin Gurry's great lines, for instance, there's been this we're in an era now of fake news, and there's been the reaction to the old media to this era of fake news is to do more fact checking. Right? So we've seen the ABC go into this as well, and Gurry's argument is that this misses the point entirely, because the opposite of fake news is not facts. The opposite of fake news is trust. And what's eroded is not the facts. The facts are still out there. What's eroded in the mass media and in institutions like government and in political parties is trust. So that's what the information revolution has essentially done. And so that, I think, has reinforced and, what was the term I used before, accelerated the kind of trends that I was that I'm talking about in regard to political parties.
Just one thing on the 5248 at Brexit. If it wasn't 5248, it's very difficult to establish it after the fact, though. A second referendum may actually yield the same result without interference. That's the thing we don't know. So I'm just not sure. I'm not sure even if you could prove that result was manipulated, that the British public would accept it.
I'm chronically sceptic about the whole Russian interference angle there, and in
I'm not actually. I'm not sceptical about it. What I'm sceptical about is the possibility that they'd be able to fix it, because I don't think you'd be able to convince the people that they'd been hoodwinked the previous time. If that makes sense. Question here.
Thanks, Sam. It's very, very interesting. I did look forward to reading the book. Your basic premise, unless I've misunderstood you, is that the transformation of Western industrial democracies into, let's call them, post-industrial service economies has undermined the rationale for the existence of socialist or Labor parties, and the Labor Party here in Australia specifically. But at the same time, because of the end of the Cold War and the change from unionised industrial democracies, the Liberal Party or similar counterpart parties elsewhere have also lost their raison d'etre. So my question is, to the extent that that is so, and given that there are so many environmental issues and infrastructural issues and migration issues, what is it institutionally that is impeding the rise of a new duopoly between, let's call them, green and brown parties? Because the thing that disturbs most of us now is not simply that there's an erosion of major parties, but that many of the minor parties are rancorous parties on the wings of the extreme left, extreme right. Populist, agitated, angry, and that has many of us concerned for the health of our democracies.
Mm. Well, one part of the answer I think I alluded to earlier, which is that the existing parties have essentially formed a cartel, which makes it very hard for new parties to emerge and break into the political system. One part of that is the voting system, which is quite an old, well-established facet of Australian democracy, and has lots of advantages. So I don't mean to run it down. The other part of it is public funding, which tends to favour incumbent parties and keep them in place. So the cartelisation of Australian politics and of Western democratic politics is a factor there that makes it hard for new entrants to break through. You notice, though, in countries where, like in Western Europe, where the voting system is more open to new parties, that they do get a better chance to break through. However, I think the other thing that stops this from happening, that stops, say, a Green Party from emerging in similar form to what the Labor Party is today, for instance, is that people don't join stuff anymore in that way. This is a phenomenon that I think it was Robert Putnam, first talked about in the United States. He wrote that book called Bowling Alone about sort of social and political behaviour in the United States, that people don't join clubs, don't join churches, and don't join political parties in the way that they used to. So they campaign, it's not that they've stopped being interested in causes, and that people are disengaged from political ideas that affect them. It's simply that they don't give effect to that by joining political parties anymore. So I think what that means is that instead of thinking about existing parties being displaced by sort of replica movements, which, you know, are big and sort of multi-generational and have the same kind of ideological platform over many generations, I don't think that model is going to work anymore. I think what will happen instead is that movements emerge, and they'll last a short time, and they'll be centred around an individual probably, and then when that individual leaves the stage, so will that movement. So I can't imagine, for instance, that in two or three generations' time, the children of the people who voted for Emmanuel Macron are going to be voting for the Macron party. Yeah. That movement lives and dies, you know, by its attachment to the individual. And similarly, in Australia, it seems to me we could see that happening, although because of the peculiarities of our system, it'll happen through the party system. So as we said earlier, in systems where the party system is very difficult to remove, you start seeing infiltrators coming up through it. And Trump is the classic example. Not really a Republican, but, you know, the virus takes over the host. And so that I can see that happening more and more often in Australia. There could be movements from outside as well. I mean, one thing we've lacked in Australia up to now, you and I have discussed this before, George, we haven't had a really talented third party politician for a long time now. So you need money, definitely, but you also need talent. Clive Palmer had one of those.
We did have, by the way, we did have one, but he didn't pull the trigger. So briefly, yes. In 2010, Malcolm thought about running as a third party candidate, and he thought he could get around 30% of the primary vote, half the coalition vote, and pick up a few of the Labor votes at the process, but he didn't want to break the two-party system. I think John Howard was also in his ear at the time.
I remember at the time reading media reports about how hard the Liberal Party worked to keep him inside.
Yeah. And the work was done. It was contracted out. I'd like to see it one day. Hopefully he'll put it in his new book, which has now been pushed back to April next year, I saw in dispatches. I don't think he'll talk about that side of it. But yeah, there was a theoretical possibility in 2010 because it was such a terrible choice. Neither the Prime Minister or the opposition leader were there 6 months earlier. So it was a very difficult choice to put on the Australian people in 2010. You could argue, but this is almost another book, that we were the first.
We were the first. Sorry, how?
We were the first. So whilst you're looking out and then coming back in, you could start in 2010.
Yep.
In a funny way, we ended up predicting a lot of the things we've observed on a much bigger scale in British, European, and especially American theatre.
Thank you. Melissa Conley-Tyler from AsiaLink at the University of Melbourne, where we promote Australia-Asia engagement. So you're guessing there that your plausible worst-case scenario isn't one I'd be very keen on. Though for what it's worth...
Neither of us, from what I can gather.
What I'd say, perhaps it would be less of a surprise to people in the region than we sometimes think, because they probably think we think that already. Mm. Anyway, my question is around economy. So when our 28 years of uninterrupted growth ends, what does that mean? If you think about Australia as essentially an outlier on having comparative political stability, and you try to think why, one might be political electoral system, you know, preferential compulsory voting, but another might be economy. So would you see that if we had a significant economic collapse, that your worst case scenario is essentially inevitable?
Oh, far from inevitable, but I do. I agree that one of the reasons we haven't had our moment of reckoning with this, what I call the hollowing out of Australian politics, is because, by any reasonable standards, the joint is pretty well run. I mean, we have a lot to complain about, and God knows we complain plenty. But, you know, compared to the way the Americans have managed a kind of civilized form of capitalism, we've done it pretty well. So like I say, my argument is that the trends are pretty common across the Western world. The one thing that's missing in Australia is that we haven't really had our moment of reckoning where we've said, you know, the ruling class, but that's... That's a
comma on us at the end of the session.
The political class has really left us in the lurch here, and yes, it may be a recession which brings that on, and so that may be the moment where the dam breaks, as I mentioned earlier in response to George's question about elections, the vote for the minor parties not actually being reflected in the way the House of Representatives is distributed. But that may be the moment the dam breaks when the recession arrives. And I've got no doubt that that will raise large questions about immigration. The idea that one of the major parties could be sort of hijacked by a fringe idea that we should stop immigration altogether. I mean, I wrote the book and I still resist that idea. You know, I think it's a plausible worst case scenario. But what I keep coming back to is the point that none of our predictions of stability and normality around the world are holding firm anymore. Yeah. So many weird things have happened in electoral politics around the Western world. And like I say, I argue that the core reason in all of those countries is major party decline. And that's happening here too. As I said, we just haven't had our moment of reckoning yet.
Down the front. Let's make this the last one. Then we'll sell some books.
Thanks. You mentioned weird things happening. Do you see any likelihood of us getting to a first-past-the-post voting system?
No, I don't. I mean, it's simply too hard for the political parties to really agree on that. I mean, there are too many vested interests to stop that kind of thing from happening. There are really too many vested interests, I think, within the party system. What can I say on the broader question? I'm sorry, you've taken me by surprise. It's not something I've thought a lot about. George, help me out.
I can help you out. If you think about the incentives for moving to that system, it's when one of the main parties senses the other party's collapsing. Taking Melissa's question, there is a scenario in the next 3 to 6 years, if there's a recession and there's an incumbent coalition government, that basically destroys the conservative side of politics. It'd be very difficult to argue for re-election in a recessed environment, because our history tells us we tend to swing to Labor in recession because people trust the Labor Party with the safety net. They don't think the coalition is on their side in a recession. In that instance, especially if that party fragmented in opposition... although Labor people are probably not as dastardly in their thought processes, but you can, depending on how big your win is, just basically change the electoral system. Remember all the way back to the Whitlam government. What was Gough trying to do in 72 after he got into power? He thought that the electoral system was rigged against him for the previous, because we didn't have one vote, one value, and he was moving to that situation and wanted to get there in the Senate as well, but needed both chambers to be able to pull it off. And, of course, a lot of the resistance in the early 70s to the Whitlam government was the voting system. That was primarily the first argument in the Double D of 1974. I can see a scenario, but I don't see any evil geniuses in the Labor Party that would think to the next step to go to a first-past-the-post after they won in a landslide. So you'd only do it after you've won in a landslide. So that's your worst-case scenario, just to answer your question. I don't necessarily see it, but I can see the logic in it happening under those circumstances. And the public's pretty disengaged anyway. We're polarised but disengaged as an electorate at the moment. And you could pretty much, in a supermajority scenario, even if it lasted for a single term, you could ram a lot of stuff through. And you wouldn't get much scrutiny. And then you've changed the system. So, very interesting question. I hadn't thought of it either, but very interesting question. The British situation is interesting, though, coming into this general election, because that result could scatter everywhere. Liberal Democrats cannibalise the Labour vote. You've got Scottish issue, so you probably have an entire part of Westminster voting on national identity. You have England going one direction, but you might have the Tory vote splitting between UKIP and England or whatever the version of the full-on Brexit model is. But in some of those seats, if you've got three or four people, three or four candidates in the 20s, anyone could finish first. We did have, by the way, very quickly, we did have, some of you know the state electorate of Prahran. Two elections ago, it was a Liberal seat. Sorry, it was a Labor seat two elections ago. It went to Liberal, then it went to Green. And how did that happen? Over the course of two elections, the vote was split a third, a third, a third. And even in a compulsory preferential system, when you pretty much have the vote divided by three, it's who finishes third determines the winner of the other two. So you can get that volatility pretty quickly.
Yeah. So you get the last word, George. You get first word in the book.
I know, you get the last word. Give you 2 minutes for thank yous because it is a launch, theoretical launch. So I'll give you a couple of minutes for thank yous. And then we've got some books on sale outside. We've got other Penguin specials. For those of you who haven't read maybe the McGregor book on the backlash against Xi Jinping, that's one to get after you've bought Sam's book. And a couple of mine are there, but don't worry about mine.
Well, thank you, George, and thanks to everyone for coming. As you'll read at the back of the book, this whole idea was really prompted by something that Hugh White wrote about whether Australia could ever do something as crazy as what the Brits did with Brexit. And I thought, oh, that's an interesting idea. So I'm very grateful to him. I'm very grateful to you, George, for the encouragement early on. And thank you all for coming. I know we're over time already, so I won't keep people any longer, but I really appreciate your attention this evening. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, everyone.